The unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect truth, seldom met with even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Sounds like this gadget's working quite well. So, happy to see everybody. What I want to talk about today is actually I want to advertise something. I'd like to advertise sitting in meditation, make a plug for it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the virtues of sitting meditation the way we teach it and the pitfalls of it just a little. But let's backtrack just a hair before we begin that. We just had a very big ceremony, one of the most complicated ceremonies of our monastic year. We do it a couple of times a year. And as you're all familiar with, there's a ceremony here just about every week. Actually, there's a ceremony every day because morning service is a ceremony. We do a lot of ceremonies. But they don't pervade our life because we have a lot of time dedicated to other things. We have decent-sized work periods. There's always kitchen cleanup. There's always rest period in the middle of the day, which is rather important, I'm going to discover. We sleep at night if we can. What else do we do? We study. Okay, we do read scriptures. We do listen to the Dharma at a talk like this. We read the Dharma. We treat the world and the behavior of everything in it as the Dharma because it's all teaching. So what are we to make of all of this? There are a lot of components to the religious life, as there are a lot of components to ordinary life. And you can't pick one really and say, this is the stellar center of the whole object and everything revolves around this. Because actually, it doesn't quite work to say that. There's a lot of stuff that ordinary people do, that lay folks do, that monks do, that is not quite the same as what we call sitting meditation. Now, I'm going to skip to a two-syllable word that the Japanese use for this, zazen, because I get really sick of saying sitting meditation. It's too many syllables. So let's stick with zazen. We know what we're talking about, all right? Zazen. Or sometimes the Japanese would call it shikantaza. We'll come back to that. There's a lot of things that when we sit down to face the wall and we let go of thoughts, we let go of feelings. We don't try to provoke anything into appearing. We don't try to look for something, and we don't try to get rid of things. Okay, we just sit there, like a human being sitting, looking at the paintwork. When we do this, we leave a lot of stuff behind that is valuable. We don't read scriptures while we're sitting. We're not really doing a ceremony like this anyway while we're sitting. We're not working as in cutting cabbage or digging a hole when we're sitting. There's a lot of stuff we set aside when we sit, which is one of the reasons why the matter of sitting still doing nothing, which is what it has been called, is contentious. The Buddhist world is a peaceful place, but there's still a lot of argument. Okay? We'll call it politely discussion or disagreement between people who actually have chosen different paths. And pretty much every path within Buddhism has an area of particular commitment. I'm not going to call it particular priority, because the priority is a word I want to talk about later. But particular commitment. And ours is seated meditation, zazen. Other branches of Buddhism do things like chant Buddha's name, the Nembutsu. Other people will study scriptures exhaustively. Other people will pursue minute adherence to the Vinaya rules exhaustively. And they do all of these things without pushing the other stuff away. They just have their particular commitment area. And everything else, in a sense, gathers around that. Okay? And our particular concentration area is sitting meditation. And we tell you to let go of everything when you do it. No more instruments in your hand that are the instruments that other schools of Buddhism sometimes regard as indispensable. There's a lot you've got to give up. And when you're sitting facing the wall, you give up scriptures. You give up talk. You give up thought. You give up ceremony. You give up sleep, we hope. Like, we sincerely trust that we will give up sleep when we sit. We give up physical work while we sit. And yet, there are components of many of these other things still present with us, okay? Because to sit formally is a kind of ceremony in and of itself. It is physical work. You can tell that by the ache you get in your back, right? Thoughts, whether you like it or not, are going to arise, so you're not entirely, certainly not able to dispose of thought. But we let go of all of these things. If there's a pain in the back, letting go of it is the only way to cope, really. I mean, you can move a little, and that's allowed, not a problem. But in the long run, it is letting go of the discomfort that washes the discomfort away. It's letting go of the thought that washes the thought away. It's letting go of the ceremonial aspect that allows you to be a very ordinary person. Not a ceremonial person, just a very ordinary, dumb, put-together kind of biological being sitting there looking at the paintwork, which is the gateway in. What Sojiji called ordinary mind. Ordinary mind is the way, was the motto of Sojiji. And it's true. We need to be careful with seated meditation because we let go of so much. There's no doubt that keeping the Vinaya rules, reading the scriptures, talking about the Dharma, keeping the monastic rules, keeping the lay rules, keeping the precepts, that all of these things, they have enormous merit. When you sit down to meditate, you have to let go of that merit. You just let it fall through your fingers. Okay? You're not even passing it on to somebody else. In a sense, it's not happening. Now, this is a lot to give up. A lot of people, when they begin to meditate, adopt certain provisional practices that kind of help get the ball rolling. Mm-hmm. They'll count their breaths. People aware of that practice? It's sometimes taught to folk count your breaths. Or watch the breath, which is the next step away from that. Some people are taught to adopt a particular koan. They do this in the Rinzai school, where actually you are dealing with a profound matter that is verbalized. Okay, it's described in words. And the words of that koan will arise before you when you sit. And if they don't, you raise them. Okay, you keep it before you. There are a lot of things that can provisionally be used to help penetrate the first few layers of yourself in seated meditation. But in the long run, you've got to let go of them too. You can't go counting your breath forever. Okay, all you do is learn the numbers from 1 to 10. In the end, it's something you have to let go of. And the same's true with the koans. The Rinzai series of koans eventually ends with no koans. You let go of it. And eventually, in our school, in Soto Zen, you seriously have to just take the risk on faith. This is why it is the great practice of faith to sit in Zazen. You take the great risk of putting your tools down and approaching the matter with empty hands. You don't have anything to work with. Okay? No crowbar to lift the rock with, nothing to shift the mind with, no thoughts to make the mind feel better, not even a sentence from teaching to try and curb your inclinations to grow the wrong way. You just got to take it raw in the end. In fact, a long time before the end. Because the practice of faith is thus. It doesn't have particular forms. And it doesn't have a tool pack. And it doesn't have an agenda. There's a lot you have to give up. There are comments made in the Buddhist world sometimes about the unreliability of Zazen. In the East, Rav Master Jiu told me one time when I and my family went to visit Malaysia, she said, you're going to run into some stuff you wouldn't expect. She said, lay people don't do meditation. They are actually, now they haven't actually been taught this, but she said they have developed the almost universal thesis that if lay people meditate, they will go mad, unquote. They avoid it. Although in Penang, I was approached by a couple of young Chinese people, not the old timers, but a couple of young people, and they asked me to teach them how to meditate, and I couldn't do that because then I'd be coming between them and the tradition they belong to. It'd be trouble. But seated meditation is treated with wariness by quite a large proportion of the Buddhist population of our world. In America, this isn't true. We gobble the stuff, okay? It's the reason we come to a monastery is to learn how to meditate. I mean, how many people came to learn to do ceremonies? Not a lot, all right? Most of the time, when intro retreatants come, they come because they want to learn this thing, this meditation thing. Or they've actually had a practice of their own that could be 25 years old, and they've been at it for a long time, and they come to see what we do. Okay? But the thing folks come for is the meditation. And I'm sure there are exceptions to that. But by and large, I think it's mostly true. Which is one of the first things, one of the reasons why one of the first things we teach at intro retreats is meditation practice. You know, on the Friday evening of a weekend retreat, there's time devoted specifically, quite a lot of time, devoted specifically to the practice of seated zazen. How to do it. It's never separated out from all of the other things we do, but it is specifically taught. So America is a little different from a lot of the Buddhist world in this respect. A lot of Buddhists will avoid it. Americans don't, or seem not to. A lot of parts of the Buddhist world are very concerned about matters of moral behavior. We like to think Americans are too. And by and large, I think, yes, we are. We come for the precepts too. But there are some places where the rules, particularly the monastics' rules for monastics, are taken with extreme seriousness and used as an instrument to help people break through the ice of their own ego nature. And it seems to work. But it's a path that we use, that is here, But you're not actually doing that quite when you're doing seated meditation. It's embodied in there and there's no separation, but it isn't quite what you have on your mind at the time. And then the ceremonial, which is a very big deal in some parts of the Buddhist world and much less in others. In America, a lot of Buddhists in this country do very, very little ceremonial. When I first approached Buddhism, I thought ceremonial was yucky. It felt like, you know, this was a piece of outdated glue I didn't want to get stuck to. But, you know, wears off. The prejudice against ceremonial, which seems to be something that is particularly a viewpoint of folks who are well-educated or have been exposed to the relatively well-educated mental phenomena of things like democracy and freedom of will and all the stuff that we're actually within our environment we take for granted, it tends to move you away from things like ceremonial. We tend to start equating it with magic and crud like that. Our minds do run through so many strange channels when we try to think about things that matter. Things that don't matter very much, we find easy to think about. But Zazen is something that's a little difficult to think about. If I would have just asked for, you know, a hands up, volunteering from people here is to answer the question, what is Zazen? I don't think I'd have a lot of takers. Nobody wants to answer that question. Even Dogen doesn't answer that question, doesn't really try to. He'll talk a lot about Zazen, but he won't answer that question. Same as I can remember in the early days, it was a favorite question for monks to ask Reverend Master Jiyu. They'd ask, what is a monk? And she used to get a little bit annoyed when they asked that question. I could never figure out why. It took me years to figure out that maybe it wasn't a good question. Because it doesn't really have an answer. All you can do is say, well, it's not this, and it's not that. And things, you know, you can't really kind of put your finger on what it is. I guess what I want to say more than anything else is that it is good for us to be very grateful for the teaching of how to do Zazen. Because it does work. Whether other things work as well doesn't have to matter right now. That's other people's problem. If you want to do Zazen, if you want to learn how to do Zazen, if you want to practice Zazen, one has a great deal of difficulty not being grateful for the privilege of being taught it. You know, this is a good thing. Gratitude on the one hand helps sterilize the mind, just to sterilize the terrible word, helps to purify the mind of cynical thoughts, if nothing else. The other thing we have to be careful of in the Zazen school, which Dogen hated the word school, but I'm going to use it. In what we do here, the thing we have to be wary of is our own natural propensities, our proclivities towards treating all the other stuff, like rules, precepts, scriptures, as though they actually didn't matter, as though we'd left them behind. We must be careful not to do that. In a sense, when we sit in meditation, we carry all of the rules and all of the scripture with us, kind of in the palm of your hand, maybe, and you're constantly letting go of it. But that, in a sense, doesn't stop it from being there. It's very important not to split things up and say, this is what I do, I don't do the rest. You find in the old conversations between masters and disciples from China, it was a common theme of those conversations that, you know, have largely been recorded in things like the Blue Cliff Record and so forth. One of the common themes was a disciple coming to a master and asking the master the value of scriptures. Under the circumstances of Zazen, what's the value in scriptures? Are they worth anything? And a conversation would ensue in which the master almost always would make it very clear to the disciple they were worth something. These are not garbage. And what do you do when you sit and face the wall? Which is, you don't read them. It's a paradox. It's a difficult thing. We have to find our way through it by simply doing it and not leaving anything behind. You can't pick and choose. The question of picking and choosing is central to Buddhism. That it's a thing you cannot afford to do. Admittedly, if you're confronted with two plates of food, one is laced with arsenic and the other is not, you pick one. All right? Nobody is asking you to just close your eyes and just sort of like that, because that's not the way life continues. And if one were to try and do that, one would in fact be extremely picky choosy, because you'd be choosing a variety of innocence you are not entitled to, a variety of naivety you can't afford. Picking and choosing is a thing we're asked not to do. Even when we choose to belong to a Buddhist church that emphasizes sitting meditation, we're asked not to actually choose it. We just allow it to be what we do and leave it at that. You start going into the picky-choosy business, your mind becomes very unhappy with itself very quickly, because such thought is complex and it leads to self-doubt, self-reproach, self-contempt, and you're in a bad region of the world when you go there. It's best not to go that direction. So we have to be aware of how to leave things behind, how to set things aside, how to let go without pushing things away. The difference between letting go and pushing away is profound. And it's very difficult to explain. I'm finding it difficult to talk about. We can only find it through the experience of what hurts and what helps. We can work our way through this matter. Everybody can. There are other things also we need to be wary of. And I think the greatest of them is that meditation, letting go of things, it's frightening. Most people fear it at some level or other. They can sublimate fear into desire, which is, of course, what people do all the time. And tell themselves they love meditation. Yummy, give me more, that kind of thing. Better not to indulge that thought too much, because you never know quite where it's been or where it came from. Meditation by itself is not dependent on our liking it or not liking it. It doesn't care. And actually, we don't need to worry too much about whether we like it or not either. It doesn't have to feel good. It doesn't have to feel like it's loaded with promise or is going to be wonderful. It just doesn't. And to face the fact that we have a little fear of this is wise. We don't have any defenses up. Or at least we allow them to go down when we sit facing the wall. We have no idea what's happening behind our back, except that occasionally stuff's happening back there. People squeak. In a traditional Sojiji-style meditation hall, people would sit facing the wall and there would be Zendo monitors formally, very carefully, very quietly walking behind, carrying a kyosaku at various times during a meditation period. They were behind you. You have to learn to live with that which is behind you and don't react. You also have to learn to live with what's inside you. Most people don't like it really very much. If there isn't sickness, at least there's discomfort. If there isn't discomfort, at least we're either overweight or tired or something or other. There's always something wrong with us physically. And our minds are not much more comfortable than that. In fact, sometimes they're much worse. Who wants to sit down and face a wall for 40 minutes nursing thoughts that will not go away of grudge towards the person who's sitting next to you? It feels awful, okay? You reproach yourself on moral grounds, but besides that, it's like swallowing poison. It eats at you, feels bad. We feel intimidated by our own solitary presence. That's why so many people don't like to be alone very much. Hermitages don't appeal to a lot of people. They do appeal to a lot of other people who, like me, who would probably do well to consider why they like them so much. There's something wrong with everything. And most of what's wrong is, well, what seems to be wrong is not a very good word for it, but there's difficulty in everything, mostly in us. It's not comfortable, which is just fine. A little discomfort, particularly of the profounder nature, not just a sore leg, but that sense of uneasiness within, can keep us lively aware of the fact that we have given up a lot of very valuable things to do this. We have given up attachment to scriptures, vinayas, a lot of stuff to merit the privilege of sitting quietly doing nothing. The price is high. And it's good to be aware of that uneasiness that comes when you're alone and you don't have some kind of spiritual big stick in your hands to cope with what arises. You don't have anything. It's also possible to be very, as I said before, very grateful for the opportunity to face our little devils on relatively safe ground. It's relatively safe. We are probably not going to have the roof land on us. We're probably not going to be assaulted by my disciple outlaws. We're probably not going to just die of a heart attack. Probably not while sitting in meditation, although I'm sure it happens often enough. By and large, I think we're in a safe place. We're also surrounded by people whom we have reason to trust have at least acceptable states of mind and motives that we can trust them enough to sit in the dark with our back turned to them. Okay? We'll take our chances. I'll take my chance on you, crowd, any day. Not necessarily a crowd of motorcycle outlaws, but you folks, yeah. Okay. don't let me down. And I guess it's hard for me to put myself in the position of a layperson because it's been a long time. But I guess you've got a lot to trust in the monks. You know, are they telling me what's best for me? Are they telling me the truth that they've been told? Are they telling me all of it? Or am I being subject to a peculiar kind of educational selectivity? Have I been sorted out as the ones to be corralled in the dumb section? Have I misbehaved? You know, so many stupid thoughts can go through the mind. Meditation is not, it's not good for meditation to be easy. Now, Keizan, you know, 13th century teacher, descended from Dogen by a couple of generations, he called Zazen the easy way. Okay. Elsewhere, he speaks of easy and difficult. It's actually in this wonderful book here, which I can highly recommend, even though it's written. It's Buddhist Writings, wonderful book. It's got an essay in there by Keizan on how to do pure meditation. It's another one by Bodhidharma, too, with almost the same title. Keizan says, yes, this is the easy way. The comfortable way is another word that's sometimes used. I think Dogen used that word. But in his essay here, Keizan points out that it doesn't matter whether it's easy or difficult. You've got to do it anyway. I mean, the same is true of any job. If you're going to do it, then whether it's easy or difficult is immaterial. It has to be. Otherwise, all you're going to do is complain on the one hand or feel pleased with yourself on the other, neither of which gets the hole dug or whatever it is that you have to do. Digging a hole is what it is. It's not easy and it's not difficult. It's just a hole to dig. Same's true with meditation. You've got to let go of this easy, difficult stuff. And then face the fact that it's difficult. And face the fact also that sometimes it is effortless. So the whole gamut of options are coasting around in there. You're not going to get rid of any of them. The opposites don't disappear just because you're supposed to transcend them. That isn't quite what happens. They don't suddenly, miraculously turn into the same as each other. They're not supposed to. So being a little bit afraid of Zazen is fine. I can remember a year or two ago, a year and a half maybe, I went through a period of being perceptibly, noticeably afraid of going to Zazen. You know, walking over from my house. Now, it wasn't this kind of terrified in the dark sort of fear, but I could feel it in there. It was gentle, it was small, it was handleable, but I'd rather not go, you know? But I went anyway. Always make a point of going anywhere. It's been a long time since I found pleasure in it. I haven't found actual pleasure. Well, that's not quite true. Okay, it's been a long time since I could rely on the pleasure centers of my brain for getting me through 40 minutes of meditation. Does that make sense? Because actually that's what I mean. It's a little tricky. Having it feel good doesn't mean that it's working. Okay? It is not a signpost that says, this is for me. Actually, it could still not be. You could be still out in Lulu Land. If it feels good, it feels good. It doesn't mean anything beyond that point. Zero. As the man said, the whole idea of saying when there is smoke, there is fire is probably delusory. Where there is smoke, there is smoke. Where there is fire, there is fire. The fact that one may be evidence of the other is defensible in a situation where you are looking for defenses. As in trying to protect your house against being burned down. But if you're not looking for a defense mechanism at the time, if you're in fact trying to let go of defense mechanisms, then thinking deductively in that manner leads you nowhere. Just take smoke as smoke and fire as fire. If it feels good, it feels good. End of sentence. If it feels bad, it feels bad. Again, end of sentence. It doesn't mean anything. Most of the time. I don't want to go on too long today, partly because this is a difficult subject to talk about and there's a limit to the amount of talk that you can produce. But mostly because it's a practice that can only be discovered in the doing. Matters that easy and difficult, for instance, will realistically arise when you do it. There's no question. Sometimes it's difficult and sometimes it's easy. But you can't afford to let those things matter. Sometimes when we sit, matters of the precepts, for instance, will arise very acutely. We can sometimes see very clearly mistakes we have made or in the process of continuing to make. Like, these things like this can become very, very clear in meditation. It is very important to understand that the precepts never dissolve, disappear, climb into a hole and die. They never do. They are part of eternity itself. They're what God does for a living. And if we are to be successful in our endeavors as trainees, we have to do what the Christians used to call the imitation of Christ. Live that way. As he did, so do you. As the Buddha does, so do we. We have no reason to do otherwise. We have no easy way into the truth except by doing thus, acting thus. Which means that our behavior matters. Killing, stealing, lying, sleeping with your next door neighbor's wife, getting drunk for a good time, anger, all the rest of it. Particularly the last one, slandering the three treasures, making religion look small in our own minds, trying to kid ourselves it doesn't matter and then telling somebody else it doesn't matter either, spreading contempt for anything that's valuable. These are not good things to do. The precepts really are significant. It's just that they're not a rule book. They're not a code. They're not a set of instructions on a piece of paper. Master Jiu used to say that they need to be your own nature. The fact that they already are so is a thing we just simply kind of have to get up to speed on. We are already beings who basically don't want to murder each other, although we have the inclination to occasionally. All right? Anger arises. Anger exists. It's almost a steady state condition for human beings, according to Buddhist psychology. But that doesn't mean we splat it out. And really, we don't want to. I don't want to tear your eyes out. I really don't. I'd feel real bad. However, there was one occasion when I yelled at somebody 2 inches away from their face. I told them, shut up, at the top of my voice. And that person went away and never came back to the monastery. It's not good. Okay, it was a while ago. I was a cook at the time. It was not a good day. Anyway, so the precepts are part of sitting meditation. They don't disappear because we let go of them. Dogen's master was a fellow named Tendo Nyojo, sometimes called Ju Ching. Our efforts to try and pronounce Chinese names seem to be variable. Dogen remembered in a conversation that he remembered long afterwards, a conversation that he had with his master on one occasion about the question of the precepts and the rules and Zazen. And he asked his master about just the stuff I've been talking about now. If you sit facing the wall and you let go of everything, does that mean that you let go of the rules too? Does it mean that you let go of the precepts too? And I wouldn't want to lose those precepts. I wouldn't want to lose the principle of self-restraint because I survive on that. So what is it that's going on? And Nyojo looked at him and he said, you know, when you sit facing in the wall, could you please tell me what precepts are you breaking? Now, that answer can be interpreted in two ways. You could say a person sitting facing the wall is harmless. It's like he's in a cage, all right? He can't get out and hurt people because he's sitting there, right? There you are. You've got your hands like this. You're looking at the wall. You're breathing in and out. You're probably not causing a whole lot of harm. But actually, you can be. You can be constructing for yourself the set of thoughts that will lead you to murder your neighbor when the bell rings. Okay? And although that's a bit of an exaggeration, this sort of thing happens all the time. People come out of Sesshin, you know, 7 days of meditation, some of them, they just snarl. It's like sitting there facing the wall has rubbed all of their fur up the wrong way, or they've allowed it to be rubbed up the wrong way, which is closer, and they come out like cats ready for a fight. And then sometimes that doesn't, in fact, usually that doesn't happen, but once in a while it happens. Over the last week or two, I've been having a rough time with meditation, okay? Anger. Of a difficult to describe nature. Lingering, persistent, low profile. Easy enough to control at the level where I feel like hitting somebody with a stick, okay? That's not going to happen. But it doesn't make that kind of low profile discontent go away. A couple of nights ago, about a week ago, I went to meditation and was doing this little 3-day retreat that we've just had. I think it was evening of day two. Evening of day two is always a difficult day. And it was like a kind of a dust storm inside, hot. And it got kind of bad. And the inclination to actually formulate the anger into doing something with it started to appear, and I knew I was in trouble. Fortunately, the bell rang. I did not hit the person next to me. I went to my room and I sorted it out. But this sort of stuff comes up. And when you sit, you know, we have this wonderful little phrase, we say, sit with something. This is how you sit with something. Okay? It has to be there, apparently. And the way we deal with it by sitting is to accept responsibility for it and make your peace with it. Don't try to get angry with anger. It doesn't work. Or angry with any of it. Angry with lust. That doesn't work either. Angry with yourself. It doesn't work. The other way of considering Tendon Nyojo's answer to Dogen is the one that actually goes a little deeper. It's not a question of you being harmless as you sit there facing the wall, because actually you're not harmless at all. It's a matter of the precepts being keepable through zazen. Now, let's backtrack a second. Has anyone ever really tried to keep the precepts by pure willpower and been successful? I'd like some hands in the air. Has anybody tried this and succeeded? Okay? Or on sheer enthusiasm? Or on sheer Puritanism? A very dangerous instrument to use. Or on the grounds of naked self-hatred? That doesn't work either. There are a lot of ways in which human beings try to regulate their behavior. Moralistic Puritanism, fear of consequences, stubbornness, ambition. Ambition's a very good one. A lot of people are very ambitious to be good. Fear of being bad, fear of failure. There are a lot of, and also the other one, nausea at making mistakes. You know? Sexual lust just makes me sick. That kind of thing, all right? There is a level of nausea that some people actually depend upon just to get them through the sensations of criminal offense that they live with on a daily basis. In fact, Buddhism allows for these things, the nausea one in particular. Shakyamuni used to say that there's a time in a trainee's life when he or she has to simply face the fact that everything in the world looks like dead rat flesh. I'll repeat that, dead rat flesh. But then it passes. Okay, it's not a permanent, steady state horror at the nature of things. But there's a nausea phase, and he allows for it, and he spoke about it. And his likening it to the perception of rat flesh is very accurate. Sounds pretty metaphorical and kind of out there, but when I saw the rat flesh, I knew exactly what he was talking about and why he used those words. Very good words. And it passes. There's a lot of stuff the psychiatrists deeply disapprove of. The Buddha simply recognized are inevitable phases that people go through. You just try not to get stuck there. Meditation is the great way to not get stuck. If you truly practice Zazen and you're willing to allow a little bit of fear to be there and come and go, allow a bit of discomfort, allow for all of the stuff, and just sit there as an ordinary human being who isn't special. If you're special, you have a problem. But if you're just an ordinary human being, you can do all of this. You can find what Buddhism calls liberation by just sitting facing a wall. It doesn't actually have to be a wall, does it? In Rinzai, they sit out facing each other. So we have to allow things to be incorporated. Most of the time, we have reason to be dubious about nausea being the classic case. There's even a spot in there someplace or other for Puritanism, I suppose. That's a hard one, right? You can't purge human life of its difficulties and call the residue Buddhism. It isn't that way. Any more than you can purge the contents of your own mind before you're willing to sit down and meditate, because that doesn't work either, does it? So all I can say really is what Dogen and Keizan and Yojo said. Just do it. Do Zazen forever, is what Keizan said. And I think it's the Bendawa, it's out of Shobogenzo. Dogen ventures into a kind of imagined question and answer confrontation between himself and someone who was challenging the worthwhileness of doing Zazen. You know, he allows the argument to be brought right forward into a matter of two people disputing the matter. And he just says, just do it. This works. Do Zazen forever. Tendo Nyojo is famous for having worn out 20 meditation cushions in his lifetime. He maintained a schedule in the temple where Dogen trained that even Dogen modified when he got back to Japan. They used to go to bed at 10:30 at night and wake up between 2:30 and 3 in the morning. And they sat for hours in Nyojo's temple. When Dogen went to Japan, he changed things a little. They didn't wake up so early in the morning. They went to bed earlier at night. If you look at the record, you find that Dogen did plenty of ceremonies, but sitting on the tan was the thing that he emphasized again and again and again. When he's not talking about Zazen and liberation itself, he talks about the rules. You ever read Dogen's stuff on the rules in Zen's Eternal Life on exactly how to lift a spoon to your mouth to swallow its contents? It's minute. How to go to the bathroom. Precisely how to hang the towel over your arm. What to do with your robes. How to keep your slippers straight. Exactly when the bell should be rung and when it shouldn't. It's meticulous. Based on most of his monastic rules on what used to be called the rules of Hyakujo, which have been lost. We don't have them anymore. They got lost in the work someplace or other during history. Hyakujo was a Chinese teacher. But their spirit and their specificness still appears in Dogen. It's difficult sometimes, unless you've been at it for a while, to believe it's the same person talking. He can give you a chapter in which your inability to comprehend what he's saying is almost an embodiment of liberation itself. It's like being slightly falling over a cliff all the time. And then in another chapter of the same book, he'll sit down and tell you exactly where to put your toes when you're standing and with great precision how to behave. And he instituted a training method in Japan that did not involve formally taking the Vinaya. Do you know what the Vinaya is? It's one of the Tripitaka, the three baskets of fundamental Buddhism, the teachings that we had from Shakyamuni from the beginning. There's the discourses, and then there's the more esoteric discourses, but the first of those baskets is the rules. Meticulous rules. Exactly what height the handle in the toilet should be placed. Things of this sort. And some schools of Buddhism emphasize the importance of these rules a great deal. In response to what Nyojo told Dogen that night, or asked him, what precepts do you actually break when you're sitting facing the wall? And Dogen had no real answer except none. In response to that, when Dogen went back to Japan, he didn't take the Vinaya with him. At least not in the sense of imposing it as a set of vows you took in order to become a trainee. 16 precepts. Common sense. A lot of rules, meticulous, physical kind of rules. Teachings on how to respect seniority. And then he just threw you into the water that doesn't have a bottom and left you there. And that's how you learn. That's what we try to do here. Seems to work. We all have feelings of unhappiness sometimes about the path we're on, uncertainty, doubt, stuff like that. That's fine. That's what we talk about sometimes with each other. When we do talk, be careful not to sow the seeds of doubt. There's no point in transplanting it from yourself into other people. But by all means, when you're unhappy about things, particularly if you're unhappy about something like the nature of a precept or the direction which it seems to point, if it causes some kind of response inside you, it's good to talk about it. That kind of conversation can be extremely fruitful. So I sometimes wish more silence upon us. I think we really do discuss things a hell of a lot. And we really do give a lot of Dharma talks. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with talk. Do it as a human being, as an ordinary human being. Nobody special. Then really, you can't lose. Humanity, it works. It isn't the thing that's wrong with us. It's the fundamental strength we have, that we are ordinary. An ordinary person can do anything. A specially gifted person is stuck. Let go of the gifts. Let go of the thought that somehow or other you are or are not a so-called spiritual person. It's just worthless. Just be ordinary. It works. And that'll do. That's a lot of talk right there. Thank you very much.